Today on Saddle Up America, our special guests are Jim McGarvey with Backcountry Horsemen of America and Paul Spittler with the Wilderness Society. We'll be right back with our guest on Saddle Up America, heard around the world, streaming live, online, and on demand at equestrianlegacy.net.
I'm glad to be anywhere, but there's a place I like the best. On the chilly side of paradise in the great and grand old west. And I'm a lucky boy, that's where I'm from. And that's where you can find me when it's all said and done. Yes, and I've seen the green of Tennessee, the colored lights of the New York night. Stood in a red sunset on the beach in Texas in the moonlight. But nothing sets my spirit free, and no other color can do. Like the winds of old Wyoming and Colorado blue. See them old Rockies rising straight up through the cool blue air. Sip that cold white water running down to make you feel like a grizzly bear. And at sundown I sit and watch them gleam. Comes so close to glory, not even in a dream. One night by the campfire light, we cooked up some rainbow trout. But she left me down around Pagosa Springs with a hook still in my mouth. I remember the mountain ride. And girl there with the sun in her hair and Colorado blue in her eyes. Yes, and when I'm away from my native state and my dreams ain't coming true, when lost and lonesome is my fate and it looks like I'm bound to lose, it's a homesick misfit, sorry face, a thrashing in his own juice. Well, you can call that skinny cowpoke at the end of the bar, Colorado blue. Just call that skinny cowpoke at the end of the bar, Colorado blue.
Well, that's Gary McMahon and Colorado Blue, and it is the first Thursday of the month. And as always, our good friend Jim McGarvey is with us. Good morning, Jim.
Morning, Gary. Good to be here. Thank you. Well into our fifth year working together.
Oh, wow. Time flies. It just totally flies. But, hey, we've got an exciting guest today, and wow, I'm going to just go ahead and let you introduce Paul to us.
Thanks, Gary. I'm going to introduce Paul Spittler. He's the director of Wilderness Policy for the Wilderness Society. I first met Paul in 2010, and it was the first national convention I went to in Branson, Missouri, for the National Convention of the Backcountry Horsemen. And Paul has been a speaker. I think, Paul, you've been a speaker virtually every year at the National Convention, updating us, I think, on what the Wilderness Society is doing and what the big problems are out there in the public lands. And Paul, say a few words. Also, maybe starting by telling, I think about everybody's heard of the Wilderness Society. I'm not sure that everybody knows exactly what they do and where they came from. Maybe get us in. Glad to have you here, Paul, very much.
Oh, sure. No, thank you for the invitation. It's been a great partnership over the years, and look forward to continuing our good work together. Mm-hmm. So the Wilderness Society was founded back in 1936 by a group of men who felt like America needed to take more decisive steps to preserve its dwindling wilderness areas. And for the past three quarters of a century, we've worked to preserve America's wilderness and inspire Americans to care for their great outdoors. We've worked to preserve wilderness in places as far as the Arctic, California, Florida, Montana, where I live, and all across the United States. And we continue that work today, both to protect wilderness and also in our current environment to defend existing wilderness from threats.
I think one of the monumental accomplishments of the Wilderness Society was help pushing to get the Wilderness Act in place in 1964, with President Johnson signing it in. Could you tell us a little bit about what the Wilderness Society kind of did to help that get going and what it means?
Yeah, sure. I guess I'll add that many of the original founders and supporters of the Wilderness Society were equestrians. Bob Marshall and Aldo Leopold.
Yes.
In fact, they used some of the original definitions of wilderness, a place where you could disappear for a couple weeks without seeing anyone. And back in the early 1950s or so, wilderness protection looks very different in the United States than it did today, in that there was no national wilderness preservation system. And there was no legislation, no law that permanently protected wilderness. There were wilderness areas that were preserved by administrative agencies like the Forest Service or the Bureau of Land Management. But the problem was that anytime a new president took office, he could direct his agencies to reverse those protections for wilderness. And so at the time, the protections for wilderness were really paper thin, and we have there's an old saying in the wilderness community that our gains are temporary and our losses are permanent. And what that means is that when you lose wilderness to some form of development, whether it be oil and gas or mining or what have you, that land can really never be regained as wilderness. So back in those days, those who were leading the Wilderness Society decided that it was time to enact national legislation to protect America's wilderness areas. And so they wrote and rewrote a law, which eventually became the Wilderness Act, to create the National Wilderness Preservation System and create a mechanism by which future citizens could add lands to that system. And that's the system that we had, that we still have today. When it was passed in 1964, there were 9 million acres of wilderness protected. And today there's over 110 million acres of protected wilderness in all but six states across the United States. And citizens today are still working very hard with their members of Congress to add protections for other lands that are deserving of permanent wilderness protection. I guess the last thing I'll add is that the Wilderness Act has withstood the test of time quite well. The act has been, it was passed in 1964, and despite many efforts to undo it or undermine it, there really have been no significant amendments to the Wilderness Act since that time. And Americans overwhelmingly continue to love their wilderness areas today.
Yes, and I think that is an important point that it's not been amended. Though there's been a lot of attacks and with the idea of amending the Wilderness Act, and I guess the more time that's enacted, the stronger it becomes. But if you could maybe tell the folks that each wilderness, though, can have a little bit of a difference than another one. There might be some here or something there. Am I saying that quite right? That, I mean, each wilderness can have some amendments to it that might be different than the wilderness right before it. Is that correct?
Well, many wilderness areas have different features on the ground, you know, ranging from islands off the coast of New York to the 2-million-acre Bob Marshall Wilderness here in Montana. But what they all have in common is they're all managed consistently under the Wilderness Act, without exception. And that means that they're managed to preserve their wilderness character, their naturalness, their opportunities for hiking and horseback riding and other forms of recreation. And they prohibit uses that would degrade those values that Congress has directed be protected forever.
Well, the Wilderness Society is headquartered in Washington, D.C., but how many members does the Wilderness Society have?
Well, we have about 700,000 members and supporters today. We've grown tremendously over the past few decades, and continue to grow. As I mentioned before, people are, the American public is incredibly supportive of protecting their wilderness lands.
Yes, it's been such a great relationship with the Backcountry Horsemen and the Wilderness Society over the years. We have a humble 14,000 members, and so we get taken more seriously when we talk about these issues because we're affiliated with the Wilderness Society, and we're so glad to have this relationship. And maybe with that, you could maybe tell us, Paul, you could tell us a little bit about your background and how you got with the Wilderness Society, and then how did, because this is before I became a national member, how did the Wilderness Society and Backcountry Horsemen get together? So if you could, maybe how you got into it and your background and how you got with the Backcountry Horsemen.
Sure. Yeah, so I grew up in California, and since I was very young, I always had a strong interest in the environment. And as I, you know, grew older and saw the world around me changing and lands being lost to development, it really struck a chord with me, and I realized that protecting our natural environment and our you know, open spaces was something that was really important to me and that I wanted to work on. So starting with my time in college and ever since then, I've worked for protection of our environment, a whole number of different organizations. I joined up with the Wilderness Society about a decade ago, first in Washington, D.C., as a lobbyist working on wilderness legislation, and then here in Montana working on all sorts of public land management issues and wilderness issues across the western United States. I started working with the Backcountry Horsemen back, 6 or 7 years ago. And, you know, it was really a natural connection. As I mentioned earlier, many of the Wilderness Society founders were equestrians. You know, there's just such a strong tie and strong history of equestrians working to preserve wilderness and protect our public lands. So the partnership between the Wilderness Society and the Backcountry Horsemen was really a natural one. And we have certainly worked on many issues together over the years, you know, side by side, trying to maintain equestrian access into wilderness and other public lands. But the one that really, really took hold early on was the deteriorating condition of America's trails. And as your listeners know, without trails, we simply can't access our public lands. And that was an issue that was important to our membership. It was an issue that was important to your membership. And that was really the foundation of our strong partnership.
Yes, it is. And it, I think it brought us to together with the past number of years, something of a single goal to get a bill passed in Congress that would direct it towards the Forest Service to emphasize the Forest Service on the trail system. And but I think one has to preface the whole thing of why this came about is it's really a kind of been a financial issue. Congress's, I would say, stranglehold of the purses, purse for the Forest Service. An example would be this kind of startling statistics is that the average firefighting cost from 1985 to 1989, that's 5 years, the average firefighting cost per year was $371 million per year. In the past 5 years, it's been $1.9 billion, so that's nearly $2 billion. That's a fivefold increase, and it's went from 16% of the Forest Service budget to 55%, and it's projected to go to 65% of the Forest Service budget by 2025. And so the Forest Service is not their fault or their decision-making that's causing problems on the trails. It's they just have don't have the resources. They've got a goodly number fewer folks employed on staff than they did years ago, whether not not able to fill the positions financially and actually. So it's what happened then, it became a condition our folks would realize as they went on the trails working that it was just kind of an endless fight, and that the Forest Service really wasn't able to help a lot. The firefighting, wherever you are on the political spectrum on climate change, the fires have dramatically increased out west for a number of reasons, and dry timber is one of them for sure. And so, and what happened, and I'll just give a little bit of a background and kind of lead into where we got together with Paul and the Wilderness Society. In the summer of 2009, Dennis Daly, who was our public lands advisor, as Randy Rasmussen is today, Dennis was a wilderness ranger out in the Wyoming, Montana ranger district. Well known across the country, a very nice guy, well thought of, hard worker. And he was retired from the Forest Service at the time, but he went to, representing the backcountry horsemen, they went to Washington, D.C. to see Congresswoman Cynthia Lummis, who represents Wyoming, which was Dennis' state of residence. And the Congresswoman complimented the wilderness, or the backcountry horsemen for doing a good job on the trails, all our members contributing hundreds of thousands of hours, and not asking Congress for money. So that was a good thing there. So what Dennis did the following year on a trip to Washington was to ask a congressman, she likes to be called Congressman Lummis, and her staff to ride in the Bridger Teton Wilderness, which is by the name just in view of the Grand Teton National Park, and to ride out in there with his staff, with our backcountry people, taking them on the trails to show them the condition of the trails on the ground. And I think it was a pretty dramatic trip for her folks who live in Wyoming but still don't get into the backcountry like that. And so that got things kind of kicked off a little bit in the fall of 2010, and in November of 2010, we, taking notes from Dennis, recounting his notes, he invited the Wilderness Society to join Backcountry Horsemen, the two of us, to ask the General Accountability Office, that's the GAO, to review the National Forest System backlog. And we sent a joint letter, and I think probably the impact of having the Wilderness Society on that letter, and a co-partner probably really caught a lot of attention of the folks. And so the Congress requested a GAO study, and they started doing this review in 2012. They went to 18 national forests, and with all kind of terrains, from the eastern to the to rugged out west, and those forests that have a lot of traffic with visitors to those that are just don't. And so you get a great sampling, and they came up with a situation where there's a major backlog of, when you in total of about $500 million. That's probably underestimated. We've had Forest Service folks say it's more like $2 billion than $500 million. But in any event, they came out with the report in June of 2013, and I became national chairman in April of 2013. So really, the first big project on my desk was working with Paul and the Wilderness Society and the American Horse Council, Ben Pendergrass, who's been on the show. And we put together, I'm going to turn this back over to Paul, we put together three committees, one for the legislative concepts, administrative concepts, and grassroots outreach. Paul, if you recall that a bit, if you could give maybe your perspective from your side on how that went. I know it was quite involved and complex and a lot of work, but I'd like you to jump in a little bit here and just how you saw things going from that point.
Sure. Yeah, no, that was a great introduction. I'll add one piece to your story there, is that when you took the Congresswoman and her staff out on that tour in the Bridger-Teton Forest in Wyoming, the goal was to show the kind of deteriorating condition of the trails out there. And we later learned that the Forest Service, because they, you know, they of course heard, wow, there's a Congresswoman and her staff coming to take a look at these trails. We better get out there and clean them up. So they went in advance of you and cleaned all the trails up and made them all ship shape and sparkling. So, but the point was, point was made nonetheless. And yeah, I think that report, which was requested on a bipartisan basis by members of Congress, really set the foundation for what was to come afterwards. And the report found, as you said, a huge, over $500 million backlog in trail maintenance. But they also made other findings that the Forest Service wasn't effectively utilizing volunteers in its trail maintenance work, that the lack of trail maintenance was threatening to limit public access. It was threatening to cause additional natural resource damage. It was threatening to increase future costs. And that report was really the, I think, kind of the spark plug that we all used to develop some proposals for how to address this, what really is fairly called a trail maintenance crisis. I think you characterized early on the funding problems. I will say that the trails have been caught in the vice grips of increasing, spiraling out of control firefighting costs and decreasing overall agency budgets. The Forest Service budget continues to go down every year, making the, you know, requiring the agency to do more with less. And we knew that there was not going to be additional money available, and we had to look for solutions that wouldn't cost any money. So starting with some of the findings of that report, we worked with both our organizations and reached out to many partners, including many within the Forest Service and other trail maintenance organizations, other local equestrian chapters and so on, and asked for ideas. What do you think would help, what would help improve this trail maintenance problem that we're having on the national forests? And of course, many people said, well, we need more money. And we said, well, we understand, we'll keep working on that. But while we're working on that, what else can we do? And we came up with a long list of ideas. which we ultimately pared down to a handful. And those were the ideas that really ended up through, you know, through much vetting and due diligence on our part, that ended up in the legislation that Congresswoman Lummis and others finally introduced several years ago and were recently signed into law.
I know the one interesting part of this also, the committee for grassroots outreach, we got well over 100 different organizations, really diverse organizations across the country, from the Western Governors Conference is one, we had the American Motorcycle Association, the Backcountry Horsemen, the American Hiking Society, IMBA, the International Mountain Biking Association, Trout Unlimited. But so this diverse group that maybe would never come together again on any other legislation or any other push came together there. It's an impressive, it took a lot of work. We had to explain to each organization exactly what this meant and what they were endorsing. But once they got behind it, it really helped. I remember going to up to visit a congressman about this topic, and his chief legislative aide said that he gets two groups a week coming in talking about this trails bill, he said.
Wow.
That was it was just great to hear that. Otherwise, because you're afraid that when you get a chance to speak to a congressman or their staff about something, that, well, they move on and forget about it. Well, in this case, twice a week. Good to hear that. And I think that so diverse across the country, they were able to keep this bipartisan legislative effort going. Right, Paul? I mean, it was almost equal, Republicans and Democrats on this through the past couple of years, correct?
It was, yeah. And in, you know, as partisan as Congress is these days, it was remarkable to see a bill with so much bipartisan support. There was one point when we had 84 co-sponsors in the House and 24 in the Senate. And in the House, the 84 co-sponsors were divided evenly, 42 Democrats, 42 Republicans. And the House, in the Senate, we had 12 Democrats and 12 Republicans. I mean, there was just incredible bipartisan support for the bill, leading one outside organization to name the bill the most bipartisan bill in Congress, which was, you know, again, in these times, that's really quite an accomplishment. And I think the diversity of support that you mentioned, you know, the motorized recreation groups, the mountain bikers, the governors, the Association of Counties, the Cattlemen's Association, other agricultural groups, sportsmen groups, conservation groups, trails groups, equestrian groups. I mean, that just shows one thing. It shows how much people across the spectrum enjoy and appreciate our public lands and depend on trails to get there. And, you know, that support was off the Hill. We have that type of support on the Hill with the incredible diversity of co-sponsors, and that's really what carried the bill across the finish line.
It did. And in the summer of 2016, it is a little bit stuck in this committee and in the Senate and that, but it got rolled out and got moving along. And we really were hoping that it was entered. It was H.R. 845, which meant it was an early numbered bill in the 115th Congress. And we wanted it to, if it was going to pass, to pass in that Congress, because we'd have to start all over again with a new president, a new Congress, new Senate, and so and completely start over again. And so it did pass. And Paul, maybe talk about the timing of that last few things that went through the committees to get that moved on out.
Yeah, well, we had a bit of a problem in both the House and Senate, where the bill was stuck in the agriculture committees. And at that time, The Agriculture Committees really weren't used to dealing with small public lands bills. Most of those bills get referred to the Natural Resources Committees, which does do public lands bills. The Agriculture Committees at that time, it's changed a bit since, but they were really more focused on the Farm Bill and major kind of, you know, agricultural program issues. So we just had a hard time getting attention from those committees. And it wasn't that anyone disliked our bill or had any concerns about it. It was just, we were just one small little bill in a big sea of agricultural issues. So eventually the House moved first and they sent the bill over to the Senate. And then things really happened fairly quickly after that. The House passed the bill by voice vote, which is a pretty rare showing of bipartisan support. And then the Senate ultimately passed it unanimously. And I'm sure your listeners can appreciate that passing anything unanimously through the United States Senate these days is a magnificent feat. So, it just, you know, we had an awful lot of hurry up and wait. And then at the end of the session, it just, it just flew out of both chambers and we were just thrilled to see it.
Yeah. And I do want to mention the three-pronged group here that kind of led this thing. It was the Wilderness Society and with Paul and Ben Pendergrass, American Horse Council, and then the Backcountry Horsemen. I think we three kind of always on the front topic on our minds was getting this through. It was, compared to some bills, you could say it was written simply, but it's pretty straightforward in what it's trying to do and what it's trying to say. And it was the Congressional Budget Office essentially said there was no cost to it. There's minimal, but not enough that it's almost essentially no cost to the government for this bill. Paul, can you tell us maybe some of the high points of what the bill's is doing, what it meant, is meant to do, the act now?
Sure. Yeah. Right. We can't refer to it as a bill anymore.
No.
public law 114245. So I'd say there was a couple big things and then a few smaller things. The big things were, first, it requires the Forest Service to identify priority locations for trail maintenance across the country, and to do that after taking into account public input. And, you know, we found in our research on this issue and in our experience, there's a handful of areas across the country that get a lot of attention for their lack of trail work. And, you know, this not only limits public access and threatens natural resources, but when the trail maintenance work isn't done, it turns people off about their public lands, and it makes people less willing to support their public lands. And there was just a handful of places in the country that seemed to raise up every time this issue came up, they would be brought up. So by requiring the Forest Service to identify these priority locations and to make significant and meaningful improvements in trail maintenance there within 5 years, we're directing the agency to prioritize the places that are most important to the public and to use its limited resources in a strategic manner to really make a difference on the ground. I think the other really big thing that the bill did or does is to require the Forest Service to come up with a comprehensive strategy for incorporating partners and volunteers like the Backcountry Horsemen in their trail maintenance efforts. And this is a kind of modeled after a program that was enacted for the Fish and Wildlife Service back in the 1990s and used on national wildlife refuges across the country. Very successful program, huge amount of volunteerism in the national wildlife refuges. And we know that there's many groups doing great work on national forest system lands, on trail maintenance, and you know, ensuring people have an opportunity to use these trails. But there's a lot more that can be done. And we'd heard many stories about the Forest Service in certain locations not being helpful or welcoming of these partners and volunteers in doing this work. So while partners and volunteers are certainly no substitute for the agency doing its job to maintain trails, you know, we also know that with the agency's declining budget, partners and volunteers play a really important role. And frankly, people enjoy getting out and doing work on behalf of their public lands. So the bill required the Forest Service to create a new program focused on increasing partnerships and volunteerism on the national forest lands, specifically with regards to trail maintenance. There was a few other areas in the bill addressing some concerns that partner groups had had with issues like insurance and liability, looking at some creative things, such as using fire crews to do trail maintenance and other similar measures. But that was really the heart of it, and those are really the areas that we think will make the most difference.
Yeah, you know, the insurance liability, the way that works, if you're a volunteer, you sign your name and you volunteer, and if you get injured, it's back then, if you got injured in a ranger district, which can be from a few thousand acres to, you know, 300,000 acres in a ranger district, but if you were to get hurt, that ranger district had to pay for your medical bills, your hospital bills, which it doesn't take very long these days to rack up, you know, in six figures. And so that was another reason the Forest Service at this level was hesitant to bring on volunteers for fear of injury, which can happen even in the best of times, the best of circumstances. But so the Forest Service, with this bill being out there, the Forest Service studied whether to centralize the insuring of liability for injuries of volunteers. And they came to find out that really the injuries weren't that many and that costly over time. It just, when you hear one, it kind of blossoms in your head to large numbers. But when you take the whole country into hand, and so it became acceptable to the Forest Service to nationalize it, and then to the local district saying, ah, yes, I could bring them in, bring volunteers in without this concern that my budget's almost used up already. So that was a helpful point there that we were a little concerned about. I think it worked out well for everybody. I think that when I was chairman, that I would get a phone call saying, Jim, you know, we can't get the ranger district out here, the ranger, to let us do our volunteer work. But other districts, they do, and they bring them right on. It really turned out that they were understaffed in some districts, just couldn't get out to help to train anybody. And so it just started kind of snowballing the situation of deteriorating trails that deteriorated more with less help. And it was so we needed this bill when it came in. And I think it was signed November 23rd of 2016 by President Obama. Again, you know, getting in the wire, under the wire there in time before the whatever the new president was going to be coming in. So it was a great accomplishment. I know for my part, I enjoy working with Paul and Paul Sanford of the Wilderness Society and all the folks and Ben and just the other 100 organizations. Just was a great accomplishment that it got accomplishment. I don't know, Paul, how was your feelings on this whole thing?
Oh, I think it was great. And I think the issue that you touched on there was really an important one. I mean, really, I think one of the things that we were trying to do with this bill is kind of change the culture of the Forest Service. We're trying to get rid of the disincentives for people to volunteer on their public lands and really change the culture so that, you know, volunteers and partners are welcomed by the agency and, you know, appreciated for the work they do and incorporated into doing meaningful work on the public lands. And I think it's a great accomplishment that we really, that we all got here together. We certainly couldn't have done it without the great team that we had behind this bill. And I hope that we can look back at this in 5 or 10 years and say, yeah, this bill actually is really making a huge difference in the public lands that we all care about.
Well, the I know we want to talk in a few minutes about the new challenges facing public lands just in the newspaper this past week or two. But one thing, coming in, Gary, on our, I guess, on our December show, we're going to have Jamie Schmidt of the U.S. Forest Service stationed in Idaho, but she's responsible for trails across the country. She's the National Trails Program Director. And we're going to have Deb Caffin, who's Region 8 Recreation Director on our show. And Region 8 is from Texas to Virginia, up to Kentucky, and so the whole Southeast and Puerto Rico will be on, and including that, which includes the Nashville area. So,
all right.
The what they've been working on, and Jamie's task is to, how is the Forest Service going to implement this new legislation? They have certain time set goals that they have to reach and report back to Congress on, as contained in the bill. And so Jamie will have them on next for December show, and to talk about how the Forest Service sort of picked up the baton that, well, we handed it to them when the bill got signed. And so, but you know, you guys, no, but I what impressed me speaking with some of the folks in Washington, Joe Mead, and even the then head of the Forest Service, that they really had a positive attitude about this. You know, it's a challenge, stuff they got to do, stuff they got to implement, stuff that's been dictated by Congress, they got to report to Congress. But I've been surprised and thankful that such a positive attitude in the higher ranks up there in Washington. So we're looking to look forward to have Jamie Schmidt and Deb Caffin on next time to tell us how this is all going to happen. So
we're looking forward to next month. But let's take a real quick break, Jim, and when we come back, let's mm-hmm. talk about a little bit about some of those challenges that are rearing its head right now, and maybe apply that to what that means to folks that may be interested in using the trails, and specifically to trail riders out there. But we're going to come back. You're listening to Saddle Up America on Equestrian Legacy Radio around the world, streaming live, online, and on demand at equestrianlegacy.net.
I could see the longing look in your eyes this morning when I kissed you all goodbye. And I know you won't need me here at home, and you wonder why I leave you all alone. The mountain is my mistress, and she'll always come between us. And I'm wrapped inside her arms tonight in this Idaho wilderness. I'm faithful to you more or less, but I've gotta get this off my chest. It's something, girl, you'll just have to accept. Mountain is my mistress. There are some things that are too hard to explain, and I've never meant to cause you so much pain. And I know that it's not right to lead her on, but with the changing of the weather, I'll be gone. inside her arms tonight in this Idaho wilderness. I'm faithful to you more or less, but I've gotta get this off my chest. It's something, girl, you'll just have to accept. The mountain is my mystery. This is tearing us apart, and it's killing me to know that I am breaking your heart. But girl, the mountain is my mistress, and she'll always come between us. And I'm wrapped inside her arms tonight in this Idaho wilderness. I'm faithful to I've gotta get this off my chest. It's something, girl, you'll just have to accept. The mountain is my mistress.
Bryn Hill, The Mountain is My Mistress is the song, and welcome back to Saddle Up America, where we're talking with our good friend Jim McGarvey with Backcountry Horsemen of America, and also Paul Spittler, who is the director of Wilderness for the Wilderness Society. And one of the things that we had not talked about yet were some of the challenges that we're being faced with. Even though the National Trails Bill was passed, and that's been a great success for our trail users. But what are some of the challenges that we're facing right now? And Jim or Paul, either one, can take this.
Paul, jump in.
Sure. You know, I think one of the primary issues that we're facing right now is we have a presidential administration that is fairly hostile to public lands conservation, and is threatening to undo many of the protections that are currently in place on our public lands. So the area that has gotten the most attention is the Bears Ears region of Utah, a region that's rich in archaeological and cultural treasures. It's been identified as having over 100,000 archaeological artifacts, wonderful scenic landscape that offers great opportunities for hiking and horseback riding, and canyoneering and other outdoor recreational activities. And that is really, was up until last year, under pretty significant threat. A lot of threat of development of uranium mining and oil and gas, potash, and other forms of development. So President Obama last year declared the area as a national monument and declared that it would be permanently protected as a monument. And President Trump, after he was elected, initiated a review of all of the national monuments that had been designated in the past 20 years. And identified several, the Bears Ears and the Grand Staircase in Utah, as ones that he'd like to look at either reversing or paring back. And there have been some indications in the past week that he's prepared to do that. Now, we don't think the president has the legal authority to scale back monuments, but that will be a fight for the courts if he goes that direction. But more importantly, we don't think he should. We think that monuments like the Bears Ears or the Upper Missouri Breaks here in Montana, where I'm from, the Canyon of the Ancients in Colorado, or, you know, literally dozens of other sites across the country, offer incredible opportunities for outdoor recreation. They're enjoyed by millions and millions of people all across the country. And when you look at the history of our nation, many of the places that we now know as national parks, like the Grand Canyon, for example, started off as national monuments. So these are really the crown jewels of our nation, and threatening those not only threatens these beautiful and scenic landscapes, but it threatens the outdoor recreation opportunities that so many of us have enjoy and have come to rely upon.
Go ahead, Gary. Yes.
No, I was just going to ask where does it stand on the Bear's Ears and the Escalante Grand Staircase and some of these other locations that they're wanting to scale back, and what would be done with the land if that were the case?
Right. Well, the Secretary of the Interior, Ryan Zinke, has initiated a review at the president's request of all of these monuments and has made some preliminary recommendations. He's recommended significant modifications to a handful of monuments. And once those recommendations are finalized, it would be up to the president to take action to undo or remove protections for those monuments. I will say that during the public comment period, the Interior Department heard overwhelmingly, I think there was hundreds of thousands of public comments, the vast majority of which were in favor of maintaining the protections for these places. And if the president acts and removes protections for these places, they'll again be on the chopping block. They'll be open to oil and gas development. They'll be open to coal leasing, to uranium mining, to other energy development. And we could eventually lose their natural character forever unless we can prevent this from happening.
Yes, we had, I know, Backcountry Horseman, we had, and even personally, maybe higher hopes for Ryan Zinke. He was a congressman from Montana, born in, and lived in Whitefish, illustrious military career, and equestrian, outdoorsman. And so, and while he was a congressman, I think, Paul, maybe you can correct me, but I see that some of his positions, his statements, were pro-conservation. I didn't follow all of them but I noticed some. Of course, he rode his horse in to his first day of work as Secretary of Interior. So it's kind of a mixed message or kind of felt down a bit about the two decisions he made on this one, the recommendation to the president. And so we'll see. I guess it could have been worse, but because he looked at more of them. But do you think there's a – well, I guess – Paul, you said there's possibility of legal action or maybe just popular sentiment that might sway this to keeping them as national monuments?
Well, if the president takes action, certainly this is one that will be sorted out in the courts. And there will be many organizations and Native American tribes in most likely states that will also challenge the president's actions. You know, on Secretary Zinke, you know, we found through the years that his actions don't match his rhetoric. He has proclaimed many times to want to be a Teddy Roosevelt Republican, that he feels like he's in the mold of Teddy Roosevelt, which we think is great. We think Teddy Roosevelt, you know, was a great model for a conservation-minded Republican, and there's certainly dozens of others like him. But Teddy Roosevelt not only signed the Antiquities Act, but used the Antiquities Act to, which gives the president the authority to create national monuments. It was signed in 1906. He also used the act to create dozens of monuments. And now Secretary Zinke is undoing those actions that Teddy Roosevelt himself championed. So It's a little hard to say he's a Teddy Roosevelt Republican when he's really taking actions that are the reverse of what President Roosevelt had done.
Oh, gosh. Well, I guess it all comes down to dollars, doesn't it? You know, if they want to use these lands for coal mines and uranium and other uses of our public lands, our national monuments, it really boils down to dollars and cents, doesn't it?
Well, I think it does to some degree, but it also boils down to people across the country standing up and saying, no, these are our public lands. We're not going to allow you to sell them to the highest bidder. We value these lands the way they are, and we want to keep them that way. And, you know, we've found at times in the past when threats emerge like this, that the public really does rise up. I mean, we know there's tremendous public support for protecting our public lands. And, you know, our job at the Wilderness Society and at the Backcountry Horsemen is to channel that support into effective action to make sure that the lands that we care about stay the way they are. And that's what we're seeing across the country now. And that's why, you know, you had over 750,000 members of the public weigh in on the president's monument review, the vast majority urging protection of those lands. And you'll see continued public action until the Congress and the administration heeds the message, hands off our public lands. We want to keep them the way they are.
Yeah, yeah. What other areas do we need to be watching for right now that may be challenging us as far as our access to the public lands?
Well, I got one that maybe Paul can explain to the folks. I think the one that's under the radar that's could be a bit damaging is H.R. 3400. It's called the Recreation Not Red Tape Act. And could you spend a minute or two on that, Paul?
Yeah, I can talk about that, and then I'll mention one other threat that's out there that I think really a fundamental threat to our public lands. But the Recreation Not Red Tape Act, as I understand it, I don't know much about the bill, but it's trying to address some of the permitting and other issues that have come up on public lands, and also looking to create a new system of recreation areas. So it's a complicated, you know, long and complicated bill with a lot of moving pieces, and I know it's one that we're certainly keeping our eye on. You know, I think a much bigger threat out there is there's been an incredible push over the past 5 to 8 years by some Western states and a lot of extreme organizations and some developers to hand over public lands to the states, to just give them away and basically dismantle the system of public lands that we have today. And this really goes to the fundamental nature of our public lands, because these states are saying is, we don't believe there should be public lands at all. We want to take over these lands and then do with them what we wish. And if you look at the track record of the states and how they manage their public lands, it's a fairly abysmal record. Nevada, for example, was granted several million acres of land on statehood and now has 3 million acres left. Other states have similar records of selling their lands or opening them up to developers. You just don't have the same level of protection that you do with lands managed by the federal government. And so we haven't seen any successes in these areas yet. But we're very vigilant about it, and we're very interested in making sure the public is aware that there are some people out there that don't believe that you should have public lands at all and believe that we should just give them away and then sell them to the highest bidder.
Yeah. There are a lot of folks that have a misconception about the fact that if the states gain control, that there may be some advantages for our trail users, but that is not the case. And as you had mentioned, they've sold and disposed of certain lands, and states are required to balance their budget. You know, the federal government is not. And so if they need to sell land to balance a budget or for whatever reason, they may do that very much. And a big misconception that people have out there as far as access to lands. I live in Tennessee, and I feel like Yellowstone is mine as much as it is anybody's. And that's pretty much the way that I think most people feel. That our public land should be for the public, and regardless of what state those lands are in, they belong to all of us. So a real challenge to be faced there. And I would agree with you. I think that it's probably one of the challenges that we face today is to be vigilant. What else, guys?
I think we solved the world's problem, Paul. Have you?
Well, we have solved some problems on the show today, but we have opened the door up to challenges. Yeah. And so I think it pays us to continue to be vigilant as far as our public lands are concerned and as far as access to the trails and being able to get out and enjoy, whether we're hiking or biking or horseback riding. To be able to use those lands. So tell us what your website is and how people can get involved with the Wilderness Society, Paul.
Sure. Yeah, our website, easy to remember, it's wilderness.org. And you can go to that website. You can sign up for our email alerts, become kind of an e-activist. You can join our organization and we'll get you plugged in with all the latest news and how you can really use your limited time to be the most effective advocate for public lands possible.
All right. And you also have a Facebook page, I think?
We do. And that is searchable on Facebook. I don't know.
I think it's probably the Wilderness Society. I think it's the Wilderness Society. But if you look for the Wilderness Society, you'll find them on Facebook. And social media is such a strong message today. And I've seen many of these issues that have been brought to my awareness through social media. So visit them on Facebook as well and get involved in the Wilderness Society. Jim, Backcountry Horsemen of America is bcha.org. Is that right?
That's right. And the Facebook page, Backcountry Horsemen. Yes. So, the web page and the Facebook stay pretty active in the all the aspects of what we've been talking about today.
And, All right. Well, you can get involved with Backcountry Horsemen of America, get involved with the Wilderness Society, sign up for their newsletters, and you can stay informed on things as they're happening. It doesn't do much good to know about these things after the fact. So when there are public comments that are available, there are times that your voice can be heard, and so it needs to be done and in a timely fashion. So anyway, you guys have been great today. Paul, you were wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us.
You bet. Thanks for having me on and for all you're doing. Appreciate it.
All right. And always a joy to have you on with us the first Thursday, Jim McGarvey. So we're looking forward to our guest next week. So you want to tell us again who next month? You want to tell us who's coming with us next month again one more time because we want people to tune in.
Both from the Forest Service to discuss how they're going to implement the bill we were talking about on this show, the National Trail System bill. It's Jamie Schmidt, who's head of the program manager for the National Trail System, which is probably the biggest trail system, I think, in the world. And so she's got some on her plate, you know. And also then a similar position, but for the Region 8, the southeast region of the U.S. Forest Service, Deb Caffin is equestrian and in the Forest Service. She can give us some insight into how the trails bill is being implemented here in the Southeast. So looking forward to have both of them on. Great folks, nice folks, and well informed, and in a good position to be on our show. So looking forward to it.
All right. So that's going to be another good show next month. So tune in and be sure and listen to us. Thanks again, gentlemen, for joining us today on Saddle Up America. And I want to remind you, as always, if you climb in the saddle, get ready for the ride on Equestrian Legacy Radio, heard around the world, streaming live, online, and on demand at equestrianlegacy.net. And we'll be back next Thursday, as always, for the Campfire Cafe, beginning at noon Central Time, followed by Saddle Up America at 1 o'clock. Thanks for listening.
Every day, along about evening, when the sunlight's beginning to fail, I ride through the slumbering shadows along the Navajo Trail. When it's nighttime and the crickets are calling and the coyotes are making their wail, I dream by a smoldering fire along the Navajo Trail. Listen to the music of the wind strumming a sagebrush guitar, while over yonder the moon is climbing, and it always finds me wishing on a star. Well, what do you know?
Well, what do you know?
It's morning already.
Morning already.
And there's the dawn shining so silver and pale. It's time to climb on back of my saddle and ride that old Navajo Trail.